Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:04 p.m. on Wednesday, March 22, 2017. And before we begin, I want to thank Christy Blair, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our proceedings, and Kyle Schramm from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind all committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Kopp, Representative Eastman, Representative Reinbold, Representative Christ Tompkins, and myself, Representative Klayman. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 42, Forfeiture and Seizure Procedure and Limits, which is sponsored by Representative Wilson. I will note for the record that Representative Wilson is here in the room with us. This is the third hearing on the bill. The sponsor has continued to work with the Department of Law to propose a committee substitute. Director John Skidmore from the Department of Law is online to walk us through the proposed CS, but before he does that, let me address just a couple of items. It is my intention for us to review the proposed CS and then hold the bill to allow for the submission of amendments before the next hearing. Members will notice a memo on their desk from Legal Services that identifies a necessary change to the bill that my office will draft to offer as an amendment. Additionally, I'd like to put on the record that the United Fishermen of Alaska had previously submitted a letter of support, but they have asked that the letter be withdrawn due to errors and misconceptions in their letter. Therefore, I'll ask that members remove that letter from their bill packets. Once again, there is a proposed committee substitute to House Bill 42, and may I have a motion to adopt the committee substitute as our working document?
Mr. Chair, I move that the Judiciary Committee adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 4230-LS0193-U as our working document.
Are there any objections? Hearing and seeing none, the committee adopts the committee substitute as our working document. And now I believe John Skidmore from the Department of Law is available, is online. Mr. Skidmore, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Are you able to hear me all right?
Loud and clear. If you would identify yourself for the record and go ahead and take us through the committee substitute, and if you can, as you go through, explain the changes that we've made from the original version of the bill.
So this is John Skidmore. I'm the director of the criminal division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. Let me begin my comments today first by thanking Representative Wilson for her cooperation and willingness to continue to engage in dialogue with both the Department of Law and the Department of Public Safety on this bill. She has certainly championed providing clarity on how forfeiture works in the state of Alaska, and it's our belief that that's precisely what this bill does. I will turn to the bill itself.
And Mr. Skidmore, I know you can't see what's going on. I'm going to interrupt for just a minute to note that Representative Fansler has joined us, our vice chair. Go ahead. Thank you.
Certainly. What I intend to do then is to walk through the sections and give you a description of what those sections do. I don't know that I am able to give you a point for point how it differs from what was originally in 42, but I can tell you that version U, which is the one currently in front of the committee, does address law's concerns and I think does provide that clarity to the law. Sections 1 through 7 are conforming amendments that essentially placed into codification forfeiture procedures that were previously, it points to, in all the other statutes, it points back to the new procedures that we're codifying that we're going to discuss in Sections 8 and Sections 10. So they're really best conforming amendments. Section 8, which begins at the bottom of page 3, adds three new statutes. It adds Alaska Statute 1235-200, and this codifies protections for property in the state of Alaska by requiring a court order to seize property that would be subject to forfeiture as opposed to simply evidence in a case. That's the reference to 1235-020 in that statute. The procedures that are put in place for the court order essentially require appropriate probable cause to believe that the property to be seized is in fact subject to forfeiture. The only way that it would not require a court order is if the property was seized incident to a lawful arrest, if there was a previous judgment for that property, or if there was a concern that the property was subject to destruction if they took the time to seek the court order and the law enforcement officer thought that that property was subject to forfeiture. That's the first statute under Section 8. The second statute under Section 8 is 1235.210. And this statute simply requires that the property be kept by the custodian for the law enforcement agency seizing the property in a manner that protects its value, so that if the property is ultimately to be returned to the person from whom it was taken, it is still worth what it was at the time it was seized. The third statute in Section 8 is 1235.220, and this allows the owner of property, once it has been seized, to request the return of the property. And that can be done under certain conditions that the person is able to prove they're the lawful owner. It's, the property is not subject to forfeiture and it's not illegal to possess. The only way in which it would not be returned is if it is actually needed for evidence in addition to being subject to forfeiture. That's Section 8. I'm going to move on to Section 9 at this point. Section 9 amends Alaska Statute 1236.020. 020 discussed the return of property. It previously existed in statute, and what this bill does is it amends to add a couple of references to other statutes, first to 1235.220, the one we just discussed about the ability to return property upon request. It also adds 1236.320, which is addresses remission, and we will come to that momentarily. I'm now going to move to page 6 of your bill, which is section 10. And section 10 adds 6 new statutes. We'll walk through them one at a time. 1236.300. Essentially lays out which property is subject to forfeiture, and it describes it as requiring to have been convicted of an offense. It actually increases the burden than the current law exists. Under current law, to forfeit property, you only need a preponderance of the evidence. This statute increases that burden to clear and convincing evidence in order to forfeit property only after a person has been convicted. That's subsection A. Subsection B talks about that the property had to be acquired through the commission of the offense, directly traceable to property acquired through the commission of the offense, or it was an instrumentality used in the offense. So it's just laying out that the property has to be connected to the offense in a substantial way. It also says that property is subject to forfeiture if it is illegal to possess. Subsection D talks about a plea agreement can forfeit property as well. And then Section E is the one that refers back to the change in the law last year that civil in rem proceedings should not be used instead of a criminal prosecution. And it just clarifies that this is only meant to apply in criminal matters and does not apply to other civil matters. I'm then going to turn to Alaska Statute 1236.310. This statute originally listed all of the other statutes within the state of Alaska that had authorized the seizure of property and the forfeiture of property. This statute, if the committee chose to, could be eliminated. The list of statutes was removed to avoid conflicts in state law. To have it authorized here in 310 and in another place. We didn't want to be in a situation now where we missed one statute. And in the future, if legislatures were to decide they wanted to authorize forfeiture in a particular place or eliminate the ability to forfeit property in a particular place, we didn't want to have to go to two different places in order to do that. So this statute itself could be eliminated if the committee so chose. Then I'm going to turn to Alaska Statute 1236.320. This is the remission statute that I mentioned just a few moments ago that was added in Section 9. And the remission statute really talks about the return of property to innocent third parties. Remission means forfeiture is forgiven. It comes from a U.S. Supreme Court case back in the 1800s. And so what remission does is it says if there's an innocent third party, someone who has a legal right, title, or interest in the property that they acquired in good faith, and they didn't participate in the crime, they didn't know the property was going to be used in the crime, and they were a bona fide purchaser of that property for fair value, then they're able to have the property returned to them. Now, I would note that Alaska Statute 1236.320 uses the exact same language, verbatim, as a matter of fact, as 1236.050. That already exists in Statute 050. 050 only talks about firearms. This remission statute, using the same procedure found in 050, expands it to all property. Again, if the committee wanted to do so, 050 could be eliminated because everything that 050 did is now covered by 320. That's a policy decision for the committee to make. 320 also provides that the claim for remission must be filed within 120 days, the same as 050 had, and it also allows for the property to be bonded out. I'm going to move to the next statute in this section, which is Alaska Statute 1236.330. And in this statute, what happens is that the state is authorized to seek forfeiture of substitute property if the property that was subject to forfeiture is unavailable for some reason. And it limits the substitute property being the same value as the property that would have originally been forfeited. The next statute in this section is 1236.340, and this discusses the disposition of property. And it says that within 30 days of criminal charges being declined, there being an acquittal or dismissal of those charges, that the property is to be returned to its rightful owner. And it doesn't specify all charges, but that's the appropriate reading of this statute. It wouldn't make any sense to say there are five charges filed in a case and two of them are declined and then you can return the property. It would require all the charges to be disposed of either through declination, acquittal, or dismissal. And then the last statute that's added in this section, Section 10, is Alaska Statute 1236.350. This statute requires an annual report, and that annual report is done by law enforcement to provide others a sense of what property has been seized within the state and forfeited in a particular calendar year. That report is to be prepared on February 1st of each year. Other law enforcement agencies will prepare the report on a form that DPS has created, turn that into DPS, and then by April 1st of each year, the Department of Public Safety will, in fact, provide that report through the legislature. So that's Section 10. Really thereafter, we get to Section 11 through 19. Again, these are conforming amendments to currently existing statutes. These are statutes in which forfeiture was authorized for a particular type of case. And in each of those amendments, it simply points an individual reading that statute back to the procedures that we just looked at in 1235.200 through 220 or 1236.300 through 350. So just conforming ones. Section 20 then gives the Court of Appeals appellate jurisdiction over forfeiture proceedings, which is appropriate because the Court of Appeals deals with criminal cases only. Section 21 also deals with appeals, but in a slightly different way. It allows a superior court to take the appeal from a district court that mirrors what already exists in the criminal rules. And then Sections 22 through Sections 28, again, make conforming amendments. As I previously discussed, for Sections 11 through 19 and sections 1 through 7, conforming amendments that simply direct folks back to the statutes that we discussed in this bill for the procedures. The statutes that exist are the ones that simply say forfeiture is authorized for those types of cases. There are only two other sections in this bill, sections 29 and 30. Section 29 indicates that the act applies to forfeitures occurring on or after the effective date to avoid confusion to cases that are in their way through the court system currently. And finally, section 30 provides an effective date. So that's the overall summary of the bill. I don't know if there are any questions about any specific or particular provisions of it.
Representative Kopp.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Sherwood, for that excellent summation of the bill. If I could point you back to page 5 of the committee substitute work draft in front of us, lines 8 through 10. This is dealing with the section on post-seizure hearing.
I'm there, go ahead.
Okay. So the section here says the court may order the return of seized property subject to forfeiture upon finding that the item has no evidentiary value and establishing that the property owner has posted a secured monetary bond equal to the fair market value of the property. I guess my question on that is, can you imagine a situation where a court would say, well, it does have evidentiary value, but the business or the entity, the person seeking return of that is able to provide satisfaction to the court, whether they're going to keep it in storage or take photos or promise not to transfer, sell, or otherwise lose track of it. I'm thinking of, you know, items that get heavy equipment. Perhaps it's can be a result of a DUI accident involving a drilling rig, and so you have a lot of equipment. Maybe that's part of that rig tied up in a yard somewhere, and the court could say, yeah, the agency can release it upon these conditions, but it does in fact have evidentiary value, and then put stipulations on that. I'm thinking of how we handle that in 1236.070, return of property by hearing. That language just said the court would say that the property, the court may impose reasonable conditions upon the return of the property to the owner, that they have to, you know, keep it in some condition, take photos, or et cetera. But it seems like we have a good example of that in the law. And the way this is written, it seems like it's saying that the court has to find that it has no evidentiary value. And then the literal reading of that, the court may say, well, it does have evidentiary value, so I'm sorry, I even with proper conditions, I can't turn it back over. Do you read that the same way I do, John?
So, through the chair, Representative Kopp, I'm looking at 1236.070, and the initial part of the statute does talk about whether or not there's evidentiary value to the property that a victim once returned, and it would not allow the return of that. But subsection D, I think, is what you're referring to, where it says, if the court orders the return of the property to the crime victim, the court may impose reasonable conditions on the return. Those conditions may include that the crime victim retain and store the property so that the property is available for future court hearings. The issue that's presented in that scenario is ensuring that the evidence is available at a criminal trial for either the defense or the prosecution if it's important in that trial, and it would need to be preserved so that returning it to whoever it is, whether in the statute that you reference, to the victim or to the property owner under the section of our bill and where you pointed me, you would need to ensure that if it was returned, the evidentiary value is preserved and not compromised by returning it. So in reading this subsection, I think your question to me is, would that be possible? And the way I would interpret that is that if the court made arrangements to preserve that evidentiary value, whether through photographs or in some other manner, then the property could be returned. But if you cannot preserve that evidentiary value, then the property should not be returned. So it's not that the victim holds it and then we ask the victim to bring it back into court and then we use that evidence in court, that property. The evidentiary value of the property should have been preserved in some other fashion. So I think I understand your point, but the way this statute is drafted, I don't think conflicts with the concern that you're asking about. I hope I've made that answer clear.
Okay. All right. So, Mr. Chairman, on that section, it's the way I read it, it looks like it's asking the court to make a finding that the item has no evidentiary value. And the language I'm just proposing that we have there is that the court is able to look at a preponderance of the evidence that the property must be retained by the agency for evidentiary purposes or otherwise impose reasonable conditions to preserve the property. Just so, I mean, I believe Mr. Sherwood is saying he doesn't think it could be, but...
Mr. Skidmore.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Skidmore. Okay. I don't know where I got sure. John Sherwood was with the law office a long time ago. I'm sorry, John, I know who you are. But I think as long as we're dealing with the draft, it's think something we could catch now and make sure it's not a problem for the court later on.
And Representative Kopp, I actually continue your line of questions, but I have some questions about subsection C in section 8 as well, and my thought is that because our amendment will be taking this up on Monday, you should continue your questions to make sure you've explored everything with Mr. Skidmore, but I think this may be an area in which we want to propose an amendment on Monday, and I'm more than happy to work with you on that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then, John, the last question I have is on page 7, line 5, dealing with remission of forfeited property.
Let me just go ahead. That's fine.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Page 7, line 5, where we are adding a qualifier for those who would be able to receive remission of property, and this lists four qualifications, and the fourth one is that you are a bona fide purchaser of their property for fair value. So if you had received that as a gift or as inheritance, do you think qualifier number one covers that scenario on page 6, lines 30 and 31, that if you had received it as a gift, you would be okay?
So through the chair, Representative Kopp, I'm looking at page 6, where it says that if this is an innocent third party that has a legal right, title, or interest in the property, and when you talk about property being transferred as a gift or inheritance, the question is, was it gifted or was it left to somebody in inheritance to avoid the forfeiture? Or was it properly, because it says acquired in good faith. And so I think that acquired in good faith, so if it's inherited or gifted in good faith, that means not to avoid the forfeiture, then there is no problem. But if it's done to avoid the forfeiture, so I have a claim, I've gotten in trouble, I don't want my claim to be taken, and I decide, well, I'm just going to give it to my daughter. She now owns it, so you can't really take it from me. She didn't know I used it in the crime. That's not going to have been acquired in good faith. But if I've given it to her before I committed the crime, and I didn't dispose my interest in it before committing the crime to avoid it being subject to forfeiture again, then again, I think it's protected. So it's going to be fact-driven, but I think your concern is addressed by Section 1 on page 6.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I see Representative Ledoux has a question. Sounds like she's ready to follow up on Representative
Kopp. I am. So I understand that good faith response in terms of a gift, but I'm not sure I understand it in terms of an inheritance, because with an inheritance, of course, somebody has to die. So does that mean that if they make out their will prior to being indicted, that the, I forget the word for who inherits the property, the inheritee. The devisee inherits the property, then everything's good. But if it's done, if the will's done after you've been charged, it's not good?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, in the example provided to me of inheritance, the situations in which this would come up in an inheritance situation are exceedingly rare, because it would require someone, as you point out, to die and to have given the property to someone else to avoid it from having been forfeited. And generally, if someone has died prior to the conviction, then the case is dismissed, because we don't prosecute people that are dead. So it's going to go.
It's an emerging concept.
is through the chair, is that a generality that you don't prosecute people that are dead, or is that absolutely firm?
In my 20 years through the chair, that's going to be pretty firm, Representative Ledoux.
Actually, just on that topic, Mr. Skidmore, it's my understanding that if a person were convicted of a criminal offense and their appeal was pending, and during the pendency of the appeal they died, the conviction would be dismissed as well. Is that your understanding?
Representative Klayman, that is a possibility. I don't. When you talk about a case being on appeal, we have to look at the issue that is taken up on appeal, and whether or not that issue is something that provides legal clarity and significance for the state as a whole going forward. I certainly am aware of cases that the state has abandoned the appeal when someone has died, and we don't pursue it, and the conviction is undone, and therefore any forfeiture that had been ordered would be undone. But I can also conceive of scenarios in which we would say, yeah, we know that this person's no longer there, but we're not pursuing this appeal for some sanction against the person who committed the crime. We're rather pursuing the appeal to answer a question of law. So, again, it's somewhat difficult to give you the exact answer, but the circumstances in which that would occur would be exceedingly rare, and I can't imagine that we would continue to seek to have property if we're just trying to get clarification on a point of law.
Representative Ledoux, follow-up.
Well, suppose you wanted the property, though, and I'm thinking about, it's not NSTAR. I know it's not NSTAR. It's N something or other that had, I'm looking at you, Representative Klayman, hoping you're going to help me out. But it was a huge scandal in Texas.
Oh, this was the Enron scandal.
Enron. And I'm pretty sure that the guy was charged, convicted, appealed, and then he died. And that had some effect on either a civil case that was being pursued against him for hoping to get his assets for the shareholders, or it may have been a criminal proceeding, and the end result was supposed to have been forfeiture of his assets, and then when he died, everything, I think it went away, but I'm not sure about that. So,
Mr.
do you follow the question, Mr. Skidmore? Or was that more a comment and not a question?
Well, I guess the question was, I mean, wouldn't there be cases in which you'd want to proceed even if the person was dead because of the assets?
So through the chair, Representative Ledoux, in the circumstance that you're describing, I think of that less as forfeiture and more as restitution. We would want to be proceeding to obtain restitution for victims that are defrauded, and you are correct that we would not abandon our pursuit of restitution. How that restitution was paid once someone is deceased would be, we would be seeking to collect that from the estate. You can take that extra step and say, well, we're going to forfeit it to get it, but I don't think that that's necessary. So, again, I find the circumstance that we're discussing to be exceedingly rare, but I think that there are ways within the law to ensure that justice is achieved and that restitution is obtained, and I don't think the statute presents any problems in either direction for that.
Thank you.
Representative Fansler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Skidmore, I guess a couple of comments here, if I may, or questions, really. Forgive me, but my reading is, and correct me when I go wrong here, that in order to seek this remission, you need to qualify on all four of these points. So it's not just that you hold the legal right, title, and interest, but you also had to have it knowingly participate in the commission of the crime, and you had to have reasonable cause to believe that the property was used, did not know or have reasonable cause to believe that the property was used. And then there's the and at the end of three there on page 7, line 4, that would also seem to indicate you must meet all four of these requirements. Can you speak to that?
Through the chair, Representative Fansler, I agree with you that the and means that all four have to be present. So how you're going to interpret a bona fide purchaser for fair value, if I'm purchasing it for fair value, then that means I have to be paying somebody else for it. But when it's given as a gift or inheritance, then my reading of that is you can't just give it to somebody to avoid the forfeiture, but, you know, it's not like I'm saying I'm going to pay you a dollar for it or I'm going to pay $10 for it when it's really worth $100,000 or $10,000. So I agree with you that the and is important. I agree that all four conditions have to be present. How I would interpret a bona fide purchaser for fair value in that circumstance is I don't think it prevents seeking forfeiture. Let me rephrase that. I don't think it prevents an innocent third party from seeking to have the forfeiture go through a remission that is forgiven so that the property is not forfeited under those circumstances when the person asking for it is someone that received the property as a gift or that received it through an inheritance.
Well, I see a couple of questions, but I'm going to interject in my life as chair. It certainly seems to me that if I were in front of a court seeking return of property, and what I'm seeking return of is my grandfather's favorite pistol, which was stolen from my house and had been given to me 10 years before. I never paid a penny for it because my grandfather bought it many years ago. And so I'm in court saying, I want my pistol back. And we go through this thing, and I could see the judge looking at this statute as it's currently drafted and saying, well, Mr. Clayman, you qualify under 1, 2, and 3, but it doesn't look like you're a bona fide purchaser for value because you just told me your grandfather bought it 100 years ago. And so, no, I'm not going to return this. I'm not going to order remission of this property because you're not a bona fide purchaser for value. And I think that that's both falls in the gift situation. Well, that is a gift, and that would also be an inheritance situation. And I'm not sure that the language as it's drafted addresses that. I'm not sure if that is the question that Representative Ledoux and Representative Fansler have, but you can answer that, and then I'll let them get back in the follow-up business. Mr. Skidmore?
I'm still here. So I heard your question. I understand your point. And when it talks about the bona fide purchaser, you know, I honestly can't tell you that we sat down and said, okay, what about inheritance? What about gifts? We were looking at transferring property in the circumstances that we have encountered in Alaska, which is people trying to sell valuable things to avoid them being forfeited when it's been used in a crime or was acquired as the result of the crime that they committed. The scenario that you describe of that pistol, your grandfather has this valuable pistol. In order for that pistol to have been forfeited, that pistol had to have been used in the commission of a crime. And under those circumstances, I don't think that that necessarily makes you an innocent third party who got it without any fault of your own. That pistol would still be subject to forfeiture because it was used in a crime. Your grandfather knew that it was used in a crime, and you were acquiring that interest until so much later. So if there are other changes that you all wish to make, if there's a policy point that you all wish to do, that's certainly at the discretion of the committee. I can only tell you that under those circumstances, I'm having difficulty fathoming the various circumstances that you all described and exactly how it would play out. Our interest as a state, as a law enforcement agency, our interest in forfeiture is only to ensure that justice is done. And if there's some circumstance that says the forfeiture doesn't pursue justice, then I don't see us pursuing it. But I understand you're trying to make the statute so that you're not relying on our discretion, and I have to leave those policy calls to you all.
Well, this has got all kinds of hand-raising. Representative Ledoux is first on my list.
I guess this is more of a comment. I mean, I was basically going to make the same argument that Representative Fansler made and that you made. And if we wanted to rely totally on discretion, we probably wouldn't have this remission portion at all. But I wouldn't feel comfortable relying totally on discretion. And I can't imagine that you could go before a judge and try to meet these criteria when it's an inheritance. I mean, an inheritance simply is not a bona fide purchaser.
Representative Fansler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair. And I thought that was a very apt example. That was almost the exact one I was thinking of in my head, so I appreciate that. But I did have a further question about that. You know, for part four, once again, on page 7, line 5, is there a legal definition of what fair value is? If you know, I mean, obviously we can always do these parade of horribles. But, you know, if I am a crafty person that purchases a nice antique pistol at a flea market and it's not near the price of what it should be, how do we determine that fair value aspect of this?
So, through the chair, Representative Fansler, I can tell you that fair value, which I would read as fair market value, is the amount at which the property would change hands between the willing buyer and seller. That's the definition from Black's Law, and that's the definition that we use elsewhere in Alaska statutes when we discuss the value of property. For instance, when you are assessing whether or not the property meets the element of a certain value to determine is it a misdemeanor, is it a felony, and what level it is, that's the same way we go about determining those things. So that's certainly how I think our courts would be interpreting fair value there.
Thank you. Okay.
Next, I have, and I see you back on the list, Representative Ledoux, Representative Reinbold.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chairman, I really did appreciate the fact that you brought this issue up. I'm once again referring to page 7, line number 4 and 5, and because of on line 4, it does say and, so it has to include number 4 as well. I would work with either you or Representative Fansler or even the sponsor of the bill to just add possibly a friendly amendment that would say legitimate owner or bona fide purchaser of fair value. Would that deal with your concern, Mr. Chairman, and the Vice Chairman of Fansler's concerns?
I will just say that this is an area in which I think Representative Kopp is concerned. He's next on my list, and Representative Ledoux has more questions. I would predict that this is an area in which we will look to come up with an amendment between now and Friday afternoon, and we don't need to do it during committee, but I think there's a general sense on the committee that somebody that received it by inheritance or as a gift in which all other three elements of this statute or proposed statute are satisfied, but suddenly they didn't purchase it. That yeah. person ought to have the same protections as if they'd purchased it, and I think there's a general sense on the committee that we think that's a reasonable thing to try to clarify. And okay. we don't need to do that today, but I think we get it's highlighted.
My suggestion, Mr. Chairman, would be just legitimate owner.
Next, Representative Kopp.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the I initially posed this question at the beginning of the meeting about the gift and the inheritance, and I think Representative Reinbold is, you know, onto something there that if we just had an expression there, which you've addressed, Mr. Chairman, that we say, or otherwise, a legal recipient of the property would probably cover it. That way, as long as the court found that you were a bona fide purchaser for value or otherwise a legal recipient of the property, it would probably just about encompass every situation where that would come to play. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ledoux.
So, Mr. Skidmore, usually I've seen the phrase in legal opinions, fair market value, and you used, in fact, you used the phrase you would interpret fair value to mean fair market value. So is there any nuance, I guess, of drafting this where fair value is used as opposed to fair market value?
Through the Chair, Representative Ledoux, I'm afraid I wasn't the actual person to draft this, but fair market value, fair value, those two terms are synonymous for me. If you all wanted to use fair market value to ensure that was clear, that's certainly a policy decision that you all would be able to make. But I think the two do have the same concept, and as I indicated to me, I consider them to be the same.
Thank you.
And then I have a follow-up. I don't see anyone else wanted to ask questions. I wanted to go back to page 5, subsection C of section 1235.220 about the seizure or the return of seized property.
Yes.
As I read this subsection C, if the court gets past the question about no evidentiary value, which I understand there's concerns with that. This statute as currently proposed appears to me that it would require the court, before returning the seized property, it would require the court to order the posting of a monetary bond. Do you read this language as giving the court any discretion about a monetary bond requirement?
So, Representative Klayman, the only word within the statute that I see providing that discretion is the third one on line 8, which is may. The court may order the return of the property upon a finding of these things. I suppose you could read it that you wouldn't necessarily have to have the monetary bond posted, but again, if that's something that you wanted to seek to clarify, I think that's something the committee can do. I believe the purpose of the bond in that circumstance is to say this property doesn't have any evidentiary value, so it could be returned, but that the property itself could still be subject to forfeiture at the end of it all, and that we were going to be forfeiting it in the future. And that's the purpose of the bond itself. So I think it's less about the evidentiary value and more about whether or not the property ultimately is forfeit or not at the conclusion of the case.
And then another follow-up, going back to the evidentiary value, that I can imagine scenarios in which, say, there's a question about whether a car is the subject. A car is an instrument of the crime, and so somebody wants their car back. I could envision a situation in which there's agreement that the car has evidentiary value, but the defendant might very well be willing to waive certain objections in exchange for getting the car back and a bunch of pictures getting taken, so that even though the car isn't there, there's more than enough pictures to show the car without having to require that no evidentiary value finding. Is that in the realm that you could imagine, or am I missing something?
No, Representative Klayman, I think that's absolutely within the realm. I'll give you a very good example, a case that I handled a number of years ago that was a homicide case. It was a shooting that happened at Rica and Bergaw, and it was a drive-by shooting, two vehicles, one vehicle driving off, shooting at another vehicle. And the vehicle in which the person was shot and killed in, that vehicle was held. There was a trial that resulted in a hung jury, and it was retried some time later. In the intervening time, that vehicle, as the crime scene, was re-examined, and the bullet that actually went through the deceased's head had not previously been located, and it was in that intervening time. So that's the sort of thing that we're always concerned about in looking at evidence that is seized, and then when people ask for property back, we want to make sure that there really is no evidentiary value. But for the example that you suggest, that if there is a way to ensure that any evidentiary value is preserved such that the property no longer has the evidentiary value, but rather the photos or some other stipulation is now the evidentiary value, then yes, I can conceive of a situation in which that evidence would be returned. Again, it'll be fact-specific to any given case, though.
Thank you. See, Representative Eastman has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, can you speak to the timeline of events under this committee substitute? In the situation we're talking about where there is a determination that there is no evidentiary value, how does that timing work? Because it would seem to me once a determination is made that there's no evidentiary value, there seems little value in the state incurring the costs of storage and holding on to that. So I would expect that fairly shortly after that, that property would be released. But what's the window for someone to go ahead and have the opportunity of securing that bond and making that request? Does that determination made prior to someone initiating a request for the property back? Can you just kind of spell out how that looks? Because I see, you know, a couple of different things going on with the timeline.
So through the chair, Representative Eastman, I believe your question is, if property is seized during an investigation, whether for forfeiture or for initially thought to be for evidence, if the state determines that there is no evidentiary value in it, at what point would the property be returned? I think that's the first part of the question, so let me address that, and then I'll turn back to the statute itself. The answer to that question is, if it is not subject to forfeiture, it's not something that the state would seek to forfeit, and there is no evidentiary value, I don't know that we automatically will kick property loose. There is another statute that talks about property that is seized during an investigation cannot be disposed of. I shouldn't say kicked loose. That's a very slang way to say it. But cannot be disposed of, cannot be removed from law enforcement possession unless there is a motion by the parties and the court ultimately authorizes it. Otherwise, what happens is, let's take the example that Representative Klayman gave us a moment ago in the instance of that vehicle. Whatever reason, that vehicle has some evidentiary value, and the state says, well, we don't think it has any more value, and we're going to return it to whoever we took it from. The defense comes in at trial and says, hey, wait a minute, we wanted to have that property. They failed to preserve it. They actually had a duty to preserve it under case law, and the fact that they didn't, we're now going to ask for what's called a Thorne instruction. Thorne was the name of a case here in Alaska that says if the state fails to preserve property that it was in its possession, then the defense is entitled to a jury instruction that tells the jury the failure to preserve that evidence means you can assume that that was evidence beneficial to the defense. So the timeline of how that would work or the mechanism by which that would work, which is what I'm trying to get to, is that there has to be a motion with the court before we release property that's seized in a criminal investigation. The statute itself says that after the seizure has occurred, that the party who wants the property returned to them will make a motion at any time, and within 45 days of having made that motion, there has to be a hearing to decide it.
Any follow-up, Representative Eastman?
Yeah, follow-up. So I'm going back to the first part of that question. So determination of no evidentiary value is, of course, not the same as a determination to release that property. But certainly the state has an interest in minimizing the amount of property that has no evidentiary value that it is paying to store. So you're waiting for the court to, you know, take some action releasing the state from any obligation to hold it. Is there then no nothing that would take place prior to that court action? Do I understand that correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, you are correct that if this, in the scenario that you described, the state has property that we don't want to pay for and we don't think it has any evidentiary value, we, the state, would file a motion and give the defense an opportunity to respond. The defense then would be able to say, no, we want that property preserved, we want to be able to use it at some point in the future, or the defense has to not assert a claim to the property and not assert a claim that has some evidentiary value. And then when the court dismisses it, now we're not in that situation of having that thorn instruction that I previously mentioned. That can't be asserted under those circumstances. So to get rid of the property, it requires a motion, either from the state or from some other party, and the court to ultimately rule on it.
Follow up?
Thank
you. Through the chair. So we've got to the point in the process where the court has released its interest, and the state has determined there's no evidentiary value. What's the timeline that happens after that point in the process?
Representative Eastman, I just note the court has no interest in the property. It's the state has interest in the property.
So, through the chair, Representative Eastman, the time frame for returning the property, I don't know that this bill puts a timeline for that. The only timeline in the bill is found in a later subsection, and that's on the remission subsection, which is on pages 6 and I think goes beyond page 6 as well. And in that one, that's not the one I'm thinking of. It's the disposition of property, which is 1236.340, and that's where charges are declined, dismissed, or there's an acquittal on all charges, and in that circumstance, the property has to be returned within 30 days. But for the determination of no evidentiary value, it can be released. I don't think the bill specifies that there is a particular time frame. Obviously, the interest of the law enforcement agency that's holding the property is to stop holding the property as quickly as possible, because you are correct, they incur costs for the storage of it. And depending on the size of the property, obviously the larger the property, the greater those storage costs.
Thank you.
And Mr. Skidmore, our secretary has asked you to spell the name of the plaintiff in the case that you cited a few minutes ago.
Thorn. T-H-O-R-N-E.
Thank you very much. Any other questions or comments from the committee? I think we've exhausted our capacity to ask questions for at least one day. apparently there's skepticism here about whether we've worn ourselves out. We will hold House Bill 42 at this time to allow for the submission of amendments. If you have amendments to House Bill 42, please submit them to my office by 5 p.m. on Friday to allow for enough time to distribute before Monday's meeting, when it is my intention to move the bill out of committee. Representative Reinbold, please contact my office, because we're happy to include you in the process of looking at these amendments before we get them done. And I know you're hoping to get to Fort Rich on Friday afternoon, so keep in touch with us on that. With that, we are going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting will be Friday, March 24 at 1 p.m. On Friday, we will hear House Bill 123, Disclosure of Healthcare Costs, sponsored by Representative Sponholz, and House Bill 108, Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets, also sponsored by my office. I'll also note that on Friday, we will be taking up House Bill 69, which was the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission bill, as my office has actually received the documents that we requested that will be necessary to continue the hearing. Specifically, we have received the white paper prepared by the Office of Administrative Hearings during the prior governor's administration. We will distribute the white paper to the committee by email later this afternoon for your review. It is my intention to move House Bill 69 out of committee, I'll get these words straight, on Friday. So if committee members have any amendments to House Bill 69, please submit them to my office by 5 o'clock on Thursday afternoon to allow enough time to distribute before Friday's meeting. And with that, unless there are questions, we will stand adjourned. It is now 2 p.m. Thank you very much.